You know, the reason they like reading my stuff is that I've always got real-life examples to prove what I'm saying.
There's a lot of good people that listen to this podcast.
You know, other than God and my family, deer hunting would be next in line on my list of priorities.
From the bottom of our hearts, it's just fantastic and awesome to have the support that you guys are giving.
People ask me about expandable broadheads and love swings.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Well, welcome everyone to the Chasing Giants podcast, brought to you by Osseo Gear with Don Higgins and a sick Terry Peer. So forgive me if my voice will try to make audio decent on this. How's it going, Don?
Good, Terry. Sounds like I might be doing all the talking by the time we wrap this thing up.
Yeah, I'm not gonna make people miserable listening to my raspy voice, but we've both had a really busy week. I just got back in from Chicago, and we're going to try to record this so I can get to the woods tonight, because the target buck that I have in Kentucky has been in front of the tree stand I can hunt with this wind tonight about four nights in the last 6 days. So I'm gonna go after him tonight.
Well, I hope you get him. I'll keep things moving so that we can get you to the woods. I don't
priorities priorities. So yeah. But yeah, you've had a busy week. Let's talk a little bit about that.
It started last Sunday right after church. Dwayne Hopkins and I from Real World, we headed to Ohio, and on Monday morning and Monday afternoon, we had two different meetings for Real World. Came home Tuesday. I was back at the Real World office, been checking cameras off and on all week. Had Whitetail Cribs crew here on Wednesday. They filmed an episode for Whitetail Cribs, and also they recorded three different podcasts. So by the time Wednesday was over, my voice was feeling about like your sounds right now. By the time I talked through four different recordings, each one probably, they were pushing an hour average each. And wow, a couple of them were probably a little over an hour. But anyway, I'm not a big talker anyway. And I talked more that day than I typically would talk in about 2 weeks. So I kind of feel for you. Just been busy checking cameras yesterday. That's all I did all day. I think I was on seven different properties yesterday checking cameras. Did that from the time I got up and outside until about dark last night. So that's been a busy week for sure, but at least I wasn't in Chicago.
Yeah, it was. We had a huge trade show in downtown Chicago this week. We've had people up there for, I guess, now pushing 5 weeks, and the teardown crew will be there for another 2 weeks. We set up a whole factory in a trade show hall and have it operating. Every day I had podcast fans come into the booth and ask for me so they could meet me. So that was pretty cool. I appreciate that. And if we took a picture in the booth, make sure you tag me when you post it. But yeah, we had people show up every day. It happens every year at this show. I literally am in meetings from the morning at around 7 o'clock till usually I go out to a dinner with customers at night, and I don't stop talking the entire day, which is uncomfortable for me. So usually every year by Wednesday, I lose my voice. So it's just starting to come back a little bit right now.
Well, I hope with all the extra effort you put in the past week or so that they're giving you an extra week off in November or something to make up for it.
That's a great idea. I need to ask about that.
Is your boss a Chasing Giants listener? If he is, maybe I'll give him the idea here.
Yeah, maybe. So, but yeah, it's been a hectic week, but I think we're going to be in very serious mode starting here in a very short period of time. I've already started. You're almost there. I know last week you made a trip to your Ohio property, and we really didn't talk a whole lot about that. I saw some pictures on social media with you and Wes Delks planting food plots. How much grief did you get from people with him riding on the front of your four-wheeler without a seatbelt and a helmet on?
Oh, there was a couple comments, but not too many. But my partner Ron, who I buy these properties and develop them with, he'd been struggling all summer to get the plots cleared. He's got the dozers and the heavy equipment to come in and do that. But there was so much rain in southern Ohio all summer that it was just really difficult. But he finally got the first plot cleared, which is probably a 7 or 8 acre plot. And Wes Delks and I went over and planted that plot. We also put up a couple feeders and some cameras and stuff to try to draw deer in. This is an area that's heavily wooded, not a lot of agriculture at all. And we feel if we can get some major food on that property, we can draw in a lot of deer from a good distance away. And supposedly there's a giant in the area. Who knows? Supposedly one over 200, but it's one of those deals where I'll believe it when I see it, and I'll believe it when I see it on my own camera, not a picture somebody sends me. I've just been on too many wild goose chases, but the property's coming along fantastic, and we got one more plot to clear that we intended to get done this year, but the weather prevented that, so that's on the schedule for early next year, and by this time next year, that property should really be rocking with the food there for the entire year, because we're going to keep those feeders full, not to hunt over so much, just to have a food source on the property to kind of compete with any neighbors that are putting out feeders.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of good bucks, I sent a very select few pictures that just came in. I've talked about a property that we just got permission to hunt in Illinois. Don't know a whole lot about it. The guy that I hunt with up there has hunted the farm years ago and was fantastic in the past, but we got several pictures of let's just say a very top quality. I don't know that he's 200, but he is a very, very good buck that we got to get a game plan on this thing, because we were not expecting to really hunt the farm that much this year. We got permission late. So we gotta kind of try to put a plan together on this, the next few weeks before Illinois season starts. 'Cause he's big enough that, I'll probably put a lot of time into it. So we'll see if we can get that done.
Yeah. He's a dandy buck for sure. And I know the area that you guys are in, and that's a fantastic area that cranks out some good bucks year after year. So I'm hoping one of you two gets it done.
Yeah, knowing Patrick Simpson, it wouldn't surprise me if he gets it done. He is a big buck killer. But we've spent the last couple weeks with members of the Dream Team going over the buck forecast for the year. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about that, but probably tease that up just a little bit more, because I really want to dive in before we take listener submitted questions on this dispersal of yearling bucks. It seems to be a big topic right now. You've talked about it with your social media a little bit, and then you need to make a real world announcement before we get into the questions. And I'm going to save my voice for a little bit, so we're going to see how long you can go without me interrupting you.
Well, I'm not much of a talker, so you're going to probably have to prod me here in a little bit. But right out of the gate, a couple of announcements from real world. Just want to let everybody know that Southern Test Blend, we still have a little bit of available. I'm thinking like maybe a half a pallet. So if you want any of that, there's still plenty of time to plant. And you guys in the southern states, I know a lot of you don't plant your fall plots until mid-October.
It would be a great cover crop too for people who want to look at a blend for a cover crop and still be able to hunt over it after you're taking your beans or corn out here in the south. It would be a fantastic cover crop to put in.
Yeah, good point, Terry. The other thing is, I've noticed on the real world orders coming in that we've got a lot of orders in the past couple of weeks for switchgrass. And I hope that people are not planning on planting their switchgrass in the fall. Fall is not a good time to plant switchgrass. And the reason for it is that seed is very slow to germinate. And then it takes it a good little bit to establish. So what will happen is if you try to plant it in the fall, it just does not get established very well. And then the winter will come along and freeze it. Now, if you can do a fall planting, if you do it very late in the fall, and basically what you're doing is you're putting that seed down for a spring germination. So if you're going to do a fall planting of switchgrass, here in the Midwest, you really need to do it after about November 15th. really late. And I just become concerned with all these orders that I've seen come in the last 2 weeks for switchgrass that guys are thinking, because a lot of grasses, cool season grasses, can be planted in the fall. I mean, this is the ideal time, September, October, to get those planted. But with switchgrass, that is absolutely not, and any warm season grass, really. Big blue stem Indian grass, like it's in our bedding in a bag, and the switchgrass. Fall is absolutely not the time to plant those. So if you did buy your switchgrass seed, the seed is still going to be good till spring. If you're going to plant it this fall, wait till really late. Make sure you're late enough that the seed is not going to germinate and then get hit with freezing weather. You just want that seed to be there for spring. So just a word of caution there.
Yeah, if we haven't set pricing for next year yet because we don't have the harvest data and know what the seed prices are going to be. So if you're buying it to basically assure yourself there's not going to be any price increases or that you're going to have availability, that's one thing, but not recommended to go ahead and plant.
Right. So
we do not recommend going ahead and buying like soybeans and all. Wait till a little bit later when we're harvesting next year's seed shortly. People have to understand we're not the big commodity leftover ag seed people in the industry. So the seed that we will be harvesting here this fall is what's available for next year's planting. So focus on your fall plots right now. There's plenty of time. Fall blends. We don't have miscanthus for sale yet. I bet I've answered that question 20 times in the last week. So we got a couple months here to, I know everybody gets itchy to get their plan together, but we got a little bit of time before we worry about next year.
Right. So let's move on and talk about buck dispersal. I think it's something that I see it on social media a lot of different posts. And I think people are becoming more aware and more educated on the annual pattern of typical whitetail buck, you know, how they will have a summer range and often where they summer is totally different than where they spend their fall. But even though most people have become aware of that in recent years, I think there's also a lot of misunderstanding of how this takes place. And there's a huge difference in the dispersal pattern of a mature buck versus a yearling buck. And I want to dive into that. I made a post on social media this week, and I said that we would discuss that on this week's podcast. So let's take a look at a yearling buck. He starts his dispersal really in May. He stays with his mother all winter, and then in the spring, late spring, about May, she's getting ready to have another set of fawns, and maternal aggression on her behalf or on her part pushes and forces those young bucks, those that are just approaching their first birthday, to relocate, to move from their home range. And, you know, God knew what he was doing when he created these critters. He's actually, you know, built in a natural desire in these young males to leave anyway. And they go wandering in search of a new home range where they're going to find their home. So that starts, you know, right about the time they're a year old, when their mother kicks them away from their birth area. And they just basically go on wandering missions. And it lasts through that first summer. A lot of times in the summer, you'll see on the news where a white-tailed deer busts into a Walmart or you know, is seen in a place where you would never expect one. And what this is, it's almost always a young male that he's just out on a wandering mission. He doesn't even know what he's doing. It's just a natural desire of his to wander and find a new home. Well, that wandering does not necessarily stop in the fall. It just continues right through the summer, right into the fall. And I think it lasts for about a year, clear into the next spring. And the reason I say that is I've noticed on my farm over the last 20 years plus that the yearling bucks that are on my farm, say this time of the year, early October, they will not be the same yearlings that are here at the end of the season, say at Christmas time or, you know, into the new year. more than once, I've had a yearling buck that had some kind of recognizable antler characteristic. And one that I think of right out of the gate is I had one time, and it's not been that many years ago, maybe 5 or so years ago, that his antlers, instead of coming forward, his mane beans went straight out. This buck was going to be super, super duper wide when he matured, if he reached maturity. And those antlers stuck straight out to the side. He had, I don't know, he had at least 4 points on each side, so he was at least an 8-pointer. And he was on my farm, you know, in September, early October, and I just thought, man, I hope this buck sticks around. I'd like to see him mature because he'd really be neat looking in a few years. Well, he did not stick around. He was probably only on my farm for about 30 days or so, and then he disappeared. However, there's another farm that I hunt that's about 3 miles from me. And believe it or not, after he left my farm, he shows up on this other farm 3 miles away. And I'm thinking, well, I lost him on my farm. Maybe he'll stay here and this will be his home. Well, that didn't happen either. I got his picture there just 2 or 3 times. And then, boom, he's gone from there. And I never did know what happened to him. Somebody might have shot him over that way or whatever. But it's just one example of a buck. He's a buck that I could recognize real easy, which doesn't happen a lot with yearling bucks. But, you know, some of them, Mel was one that was on my farm that I could easily recognize. And the year Mel was here, you know, he was a clean 10-point yearling. There was actually another clean 10-point yearling that same year that was as good as him. And the racks were a little bit different, had a little bit different shape to that main beam. And a couple times I actually seen them together, and I was hoping both those bucks would stick around. Well, the one that eventually became male did stick around and took up residence on my farm, but the other one did not. He just disappeared, and I don't think he got shot. I think he just wandered on. So the relocation of yearling bucks is something that lasts for at least a year, and some research has shown it goes up until the buck is, you know, he's got his rack when he's 2.5, the fall he's 2.5. So it doesn't stop like necessarily next summer. The big question is what can we do about it? And is there any way that we can get these bucks to stay on our farm? And I think the only thing we can do is provide the best habitat that we possibly can, give him the security. So, but of course a young buck, he doesn't understand that, hey, this place is safer than that place. He's just wandering aimlessly without any recognition whatsoever that he may be in a safe zone or he may be in danger. And this is why so many of them get killed in a lot of states. But I think my theory is that if you've got that property with security cover, where a lot of other deer are going to be, a lot of other older deer are going to be staying, and then you've got the food sources to carry them deer through the entire winter into the next spring, you really increase your odds of holding some of those bucks. Now, on my 120-acre farm, you know, in the course of the season, an entire season, I'm probably literally going to have about 20 different yearling bucks come and go. But during the late season, you know, as hunting pressure's picked up, as crops have been harvested, I'll easily have a dozen year and a half old bucks here in January, and maybe 15 or more. I remember there was one hunt, it's probably been a dozen years ago. It was a late season hunt on my farm. I seen 12 bucks on that hunt come past my stand on their way to the food source. And of those 12 bucks, 11 of them were year and a half olds. There was one older buck, 3 or 4 year old, but 11 of those 12 were year and a half old bucks. So, you know, all we can do is make our property as inviting as we possibly can. And hopefully some of those yearlings are going to call our place home. So how does that differ from a mature buck and his dispersal? What happens a lot of times with mature bucks is that, and this is most often the case, is they've got a location where they spend their fall and their winter. Sometimes they will shift from fall to winter. After that rut is over, a lot of times they will shift to a area with a lot of food. I see it here on my farm. I start attracting new bucks, even mature bucks, right after the rut. So what I have here during the rut in November, they were already here in October. And they stay. I don't get new bucks during the rut in November. I get the new bucks right after the rut. And I'm sure those bucks have rutted someplace else. And they're coming to my place because of the food that I offer and the security later in the year. So then they'll stay through the winter. Then in the spring, and it's not, you can't just mark it on a calendar. Now you can by individual bucks, but overall, these bucks are going to leave in the spring at different times. So some of them are leaving really early. Some of them are actually leaving before they shed their antlers. I'm guessing like in late February. Others are staying until, you know, March or April, and then they're leaving. And when they leave, they go to bachelor groups. And these bachelor groups, when they go to a bachelor group, they're going the same way every year. So if I have a buck that's in on my place in the fall and winter, and he leaves in the spring and is gone for the summer, that buck goes to the same spot every summer, and he comes back to my place the same spot every fall. And that's true with most mature bucks. However, I want to throw out something that I see promoted out there, and this is not to make fun of any person or any idea, but the idea that in the summertime you can do whatever you want on your property because the bucks are gone. They're out on their bachelor group or with their bachelor group, and they're not even on your property, so you're free to do whatever you want. Well, there's enough individuality amongst mature bucks that they all don't do this. And I can think of two very specific bucks on my farm that were mature bucks that I end up killing, that they stayed here year round. They did not leave my farm and go spend their summer in a bachelor group somewhere else. One of those was Smokey. Smokey was on my farm. It didn't matter what month it was. He was here. And, you know, I'd get his picture in the summer. Occasionally I might see him in the summer, and he was here. I ended up killing him at 6.5 years old. There was another buck that I did an article on in the Quality Whitetails magazine years ago, and the bucks, I referred to him as 6x6x6. He was a clean 6x6 typical the year I shot him. I shot him in 2012, and he was 6 years old. That buck I watched grow up, and he was on my farm every summer. So to kind of spin this around, every buck's individual. And if you throw all your eggs into one basket based on what most bucks do, you're going to end up shooting yourself in the foot on some other bucks. So these were two bucks that if I would have just did what I wanted on my property in the summertime, I would have probably never had the opportunity to shoot them in the fall, because I'm guessing I would have drove them off of the property. Just their dispersal was totally different because they did not disperse.
Makes sense. I got a question I've never asked you before, and it's going to probably make you think for a little bit. The year that you saw Mel as a year and a half old with a buck similar to him, the year prior to that when they were buck fawns, did you shoot any does on your property?
No, I know I didn't, because the reason I know I didn't is because in 2011, up until 2011, I was trying to shoot two does for every buck that was shot on my place. And it didn't matter who shot them. If Guest and I shot a total of four bucks, then I was trying to shoot eight does.
Right.
And then in 2012, we got hit with EHD and just about wiped us out. And at that point, I quit shooting does. And I did not shoot a doe again until, I think it was last season. That was the first time I shot a doe.
Gotcha. Well, brutal honesty, people. If he wanted to say that the reason that those two bucks were there is because he shot a doe with buck fawns, he would have just told you that. So well, there's so many variables, people, and they want to draw hard lines to it. And all this is ideas that things increase. I use the analogy Moneyball all the time. Every single little thing puts another little chance that closes the door on a wild animal. This isn't hunting in a pen. Every buck is not the same. They're going to act different. Every property is the same. But the one thing that affects it more than anything else is intrusion.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we could have, one thing that we try to do here is we're providing information that's different than what you might hear somewhere else, but we're trying to help you kill the toughest buck in the woods, not the easy one. And I'm here to tell you that just because a buck is mature doesn't mean that they're all equal, that one is going to be as easy to kill as the next one. It's not like that at all. Some of them are a lot easier to kill than others. And the information that we're sharing is different because we're trying to teach you how to kill the toughest buck in the woods, the smartest buck in the woods. And I figure that if you can kill the toughest buck in the woods, well, then the easy bucks are going to come easy. And another example of this, of exactly what I'm saying, is when I say don't mow paths for your deer to follow, because a lot of mature bucks do not like to follow a mowed path. And every time I say that, especially if I post it on social media, you got a dozen experts telling you how wrong you are, because here's a buck I shot walking down a mowed path. I'm not saying it never happens. That's not the lesson here. It absolutely does happen. But what's going to happen when you get one of those bucks on your place that does not follow a mowed path, and you're sitting there in your stand overlooking a mowed path waiting for him to come by? He's not going to do it. That's why I recommend, instead of a mowed path, you spray a path with a herbicide and a garden sprayer that the path is only about a foot wide through the brush. And you can get those, you can lead those deer right where you want them doing that. But when that buck follows that path instead of a mowed path, when he follows that sprayed path, he still has that brush and those weeds up against his side. He feels safer doing it. And, you know, a lot of the time we get criticized, Terry, because we say something and people take it out of context or they take it too literal. And a good example, again, is this mowed path. We're not saying mature bucks never follow a mowed path. We're saying you can up your odds considerably by giving up those mowed paths.
Well, we started this topic talking about buck dispersal and somehow got on that. So we're definitely not professionals when it comes to staying on topic. But to close this segment, I think the word buck dispersal means several things, and I think you did a good job outlining it. There's the level of buck dispersal when we're talking about yearling bucks dispersing and finding their core, you know, as they're out wandering. And then there's also buck dispersal when we're talking about bachelor groups that are out in and they're going back to where their other range is. So for the people that are just learning about this, it's not the same thing. There is different types of buck dispersal that you can read about and study about. And I think you did a really good job doing that. So let's play the... Oh, go ahead.
I'll throw out one more thing on buck dispersal. I'll stay on topic this time, Terry. So I think what happens a lot of times, and this is something that I've never heard anyone talk about. So if we start seeing all kinds of social media posts and magazine articles on this, you're going to know where it started. But I think a lot of times when those yearling bucks, that first summer when they're growing their first rack and they're out on their wandering mission, a lot of times what happens is those bucks, while they're wandering, they will come across a bachelor group and they will then stop and they're wandering and become a part of that bachelor group. And what I've seen on my farm more than once is when a mature buck that comes to my farm every year, an older buck, a lot of times he'll have a yearling with him. So
great point. Yeah.
Those yearlings, they start out as in the bachelor group, but then they follow the mature buck to wherever his home's at. And I've seen it more than once on my trail camera. The mature buck shows up and there's a year and a half old buck with him.
Yeah. I've seen that a lot too. And that buck's just learning from that old buck. You know, it's not like right. He stays with his mother the entire time and learns how to feed and learns how to where to stay. And, you know, he's following those older bucks, and then the rut comes in, and then of course he gets his tail whipped and, you know, gets pushed away. So yeah, that's a great point. We haven't touched on that a lot. A lot of times when we see a good buck, he's always got a yearling or two or smaller bucks with him.
Right.
So I've even seen to where hunting in early season in Kentucky, I would always recognize a smaller buck. And of course they would always come out into the alfalfa first. And I always would get excited when the younger buck that was always in the trail camera pictures with the older one came out, because I knew he was probably coming, but right at dark, you know, because those young ones just run right out there.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I hope somebody uses that in their podcast and claims it is their idea. So,
oh, they will, guaranteed.
All right, let's hear from our friends at Osseo.
Osseo Gear introduces a premium line of bow hunting gear that is unmatched, pairing nature's finest camouflage with the best technological innovations. Osseo Gear brings whitetail bow hunters the gear they need to be the best at their craft. The unique camouflage mimics the intricate feather pattern of North America's greatest predatorial creatures. Designed for invisibility, built for comfort, and engineered for function. Visit osseogear.com. That's A-S-I-O-Gear.com to start shopping. Osseo Gear, prepare to be invisible.
All right, Don, well, we're going to answer the first question of the night. I'm going to share my screen, and I am definitely not reading it.
I'll take care of that. First one comes from Cooper Cox from St. Germain, Wisconsin. He says, hello, Don and Terry. I would first like to thank you for openly sharing your faith through the podcast and everything you do for Lester's Feet. I recently watched a video where an accomplished hunting personality talked about what makes a good target buck. They used an example of a deer that they targeted but never saw in person, but trail camera data led them to believe it was a deer living on their property. My question is, have either of you encountered a buck that you deemed unkillable? Thanks, God bless. Well, Cooper, that's a great question. A few years ago, it's been several years ago now, I wrote an article. I think it appeared in Deer and Deer Hunting. It was, are some bucks unkillable? And at that time, I wrote that I believe that some bucks are unkillable with archery gear during the archery season. Now, you can take any buck, and if someone steps on his tail and he has to get up and move during gun season, especially, he becomes very killable. But for a bow hunter to target a specific buck and have odds of killing that buck, are they unkillable? I kind of waver on my question today, because I believe today that I can kill most, if not close to all, mature bucks if I have access to the property I need to, and I don't have other hunters there screwing things up. Now, that there's a lot of what ifs in that scenario. What if I do have other hunters on the property, and what if I can't get access to the permission or to the property I need to be on? Well, then absolutely, some bucks are unkillable. If you can't be on the property you need to be, and you can't have total control over the situation, you got people bumping him and such. So I would say, have I ever encountered a buck that I thought was unkillable? Well, you know, I thought Trump was unkillable, to be honest, and then I ended up killing him.
I said that Joey, I said you wouldn't kill Joey.
Well, Joey was one that I thought the odds were pretty slim as well. But by the time that I shot Joey, I'd had a run of success that was pretty unbelievable, and I was starting to get a little bit cocky probably. And I was almost feeling like there was no such thing as an unkillable buck. However, I've come back down to earth a little bit since then, and I do think there's probably situations where bucks are almost unkillable. And in fact, just this week, I seen something by Bill Winky, who is a fantastic whitetail hunter. And he detailed a situation a few years ago where he was hunting the biggest buck he could find. And I think he spent 50 some days hunting that deer and never laid eyes on it. And I'm sure it was a situation where he wasn't having to deal with a lot of other hunters too much. But he ended up not even laying eyes on that buck. And I think if I understood Bill's statement correctly, is that today he doesn't necessarily look for the biggest buck that he can find to hunt. He looks for the biggest killable buck. And that means a buck that's moving in daylight. Or maybe it's that he has access to that buck's core area. But I thought that was a great point that Bill made, was the biggest buck that you find may be darn near impossible for you to kill because of the, you know, the specific situation. You need to look for the biggest buck that you think is killable.
So let's unwrap that a little bit, because I hear people say all the time that a buck is not killable because he's nocturnal. My gut tells me he's nocturnal on your property. He's up somewhere. He might be traveling 2 miles to get to your property in the middle of the night to feed. But if I'm hearing you right, I think you're saying that every buck's killable, but just not every buck's not killable to you.
That's exactly right. And you know, I think of another buck, Terry, as you was talking there, the buck that I shot in his bed in the snow back in, I think it was 2010, that buck had been on my farm all fall, and I'd been trying to kill him on my farm all fall. That buck was pretty much nocturnal. I did see him a couple different times in a switchgrass field in the afternoon, say 30 minutes before dark, and I'd be hunting on the edge of the switchgrass field, and he would stand up in that switchgrass. And I would think, oh, now I'm going to get him today, because I got a half hour shooting light left. He stood up in his bed. He's going to come my way. I know he is. And that buck literally did not move 10 yards until it was pitch black. He was probably as close to being truly nocturnal as any buck I ever hunted. However, when it got to be late season, we had a really brutal cold spell come in, and I seen that deer on his feet three afternoons in a row. The first afternoon I seen where he was coming from. The second afternoon I set up to catch that buck coming from that direction again, and I actually missed him. I shot right over his back. And then the third afternoon is when I shot him in his bed going into the stand. So he was as close to being nocturnal. But when it gets late season and it gets brutally cold, there's no such thing as a nocturnal buck. They've got to be on their feet feeding, and that last hour of daylight, you got a good chance to kill them.
All right. Well, right now, usually in the podcast, Matthews Force Fits their segment as a sponsor to the show so that we can talk about Lester's feet. But we're going to do something a little bit different tonight. We're going to end the show tonight with the Lester's feet segment, because both Don and I have a family that we would like to talk about specifically and ask for your prayers on it. So we're going to go straight to the second question. Just changing up the order just a little bit to keep it, but letting everybody know. The second question should be on your screen now.
Yeah, the second one comes from Dave Elvin from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dave says, Don and Terry, love the podcast. Keep up the great work. We have seen the mature buck rut movement start a bit earlier in our area of extreme northern Missouri since about 2017. A late October cold front has always been great, but the first 4 to 5 days of November are now better than what used to be the prime period of November 6th to the 10th. November 1 is now my favorite day, and I'm talking mature bucks. We keep pretty good track of ages and have killed a couple that were aged at 5.5 and 6.5 via cementum annuli. I guess that's how you say that. Trail cameras and sightings are both stronger the first few days of November. Have you noticed anything similar in your area? Thoughts? Thank you. Dave, I actually have noticed in recent years, I think that, and I have no explanation for it whatsoever. It may be that I'm just becoming more in tune, to the situation at hand as I continue to learn and get better. But a perfect example is that, for probably 25 years, I preached do not hunt October mornings. And, literally for probably, I don't even know how many years, at least 15 consecutive years, I never hunted a single morning in October. And think about that. That's a pretty long period of time to not hunt a single morning in October and being a serious bow hunter. And the reason for it was, the mature buck activity on the October mornings was just so rare that I felt like you was actually doing more harm than good to go out on October morning. You was just educating the deer to where your stands were. Well, I started noticing a shift in that in recent years. And then in 2020, I went out and I hunted with Steve Shields here, and we was after Mel. I hunted 3 mornings in October, and I actually seen Mel on his feet moving every one of those 3 mornings. Now, we was trying to hunt cold fronts and such. We wasn't going out the first week of October and hunting a lot. But during the last probably 2 weeks of October, we hunted three times in the morning. And the last time I was by myself, that was the morning I shot him on October 30th. But I have noticed mature buck activity picking up and being better than it seemed to be years ago towards the end of October and early November. Now, I will say this all hinges on the weather. 2020, when I shot Mel October 30th, I was watching the weather forecast, and I seen a big warm up coming that first week in November. It was going to be unseasonably warm. And I thought, man, the deer activity is going to be dead. So what I'm going to do is on the 30th, it was actually a little bit of a cold front. And so I went ahead and hunted that morning and ended up killing Mel. But I definitely have observed something very similar. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to hold true long term or what, but I'll tell you what, I will now be hunting mornings in late October when there is a cold front. Those things have to come together. I'm not going to hunt a morning in the first 2 weeks of October just because there's a cold front. But when you get into the end of the month, cold front comes through, yeah, I'll hunt a morning.
Well, the transparency and you always learning and adapting is respected by me. But I got a weird takeaway from that point that you just made, is if we start to see that it is possible, whether it's because it's changed, it's always been there, and we're just starting to notice it. It could be multiple things. It could have always been that way, and you're just paying more attention now, or it could be changing. We don't know. But the takeaway for me is, in the off season, in February and March, I got to figure out a way to give my stands access to where I can hunt in the morning when that situation arises, not just tromp in anywhere I want. So from a strategy standpoint on my property, if I'm thinking, hey, you know, I've never hunted mornings either, but I may want to start when the conditions are right and I see that cold front, I got to maybe adapt a couple spots to where I have foolproof access for morning hunts while those bucks are coming back in versus a rut spot when we would usually start.
That's fantastic, Terry. Access is everything, and morning access is totally different than afternoon access.
Because you're not explaining it to the level I think people need to understand it. And when you hunt a morning spot, you're not necessarily going in late October. You're still not hunting your best rut spots.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right.
It's a spot set up that you can hunt a morning with perfect access. So the people listening take us, I mean, they draw the line, and they don't sometimes understand how deep this thing goes. So if the opportunity arises that you want to hunt October mornings, it's still not high enough odds to go in and burn up a rut stand for the sake of it. It's still low percentage hunting, but it can be done. So figure out a way on your property to have a couple places that you can slip in that's foolproof. Brandon Epperson shot that buck in Kentucky opening morning, where normally he wouldn't hunt mornings, but he had a spot he could access it, and that's what made him successful. So it's, again, developing your property for these situations that might happen once every 5 years, that it aligns that you hunt and kill a giant buck on October morning.
Right. I just don't go out on October mornings and go to my prime rut stands and take a chance. I mean, I'm always playing the odds, the money ball, as Terry likes to call it.
Hey, Spinks from Quiet Cat here in our virtual showroom space, where you can connect with a product expert and learn all about our bikes, our accessories, and what makes Quiet Cat the leader in off-road electric bikes. Schedule a live session today by clicking in the link below or going to quietcat.com/meet.
All right, this one comes from Steve Fulcher from Albia, Iowa. He says, two questions for you. I have had the pleasure in over 40 years of hunting on a half a dozen occasions to observe a true giant mature buck tending a doe. If it is true that immature bucks also breed does, why have I never seen it happen? When I talk about tending, I'm referring to the activity right up to the actual breeding, slowly following the doe wherever she goes, standing by her when she lays down, keeping her confined in a certain area, etc. I have talked to several other experienced hunters who also have never seen an immature buck tending a doe. We have saw them chasing only. Next question, what is the definition of a world-class buck? Keep up the good work. It is so helpful to anybody that is watching to be more consistent with killing mature bucks. Well, Steve, real quick, the definition of a mature buck or a world-class buck in my mind is a typical scoring at least 180 and a non-typical scoring at least 200. That's my opinion. Others may vary slightly. So on to your question about bucks tending does, and especially immature bucks. The reason that you hardly see a immature buck tending a doe, but you noted that you do see him chasing does. Well, a mature buck knows the game way better than an immature buck does. That immature buck, he's chasing a doe that's not even close to being ready to breed. He's just chasing a doe just because she's a doe. And when she starts to come into estrus, the mature buck, he can detect that basically by her odor, and then he runs the little buck off. And that doesn't mean that a little buck never gets to breed a doe, because I've seen numerous occasions where a mature buck has got a hot doe, but he's also got two or three or four or five other bucks that are below him in social status that are kind of circling almost like satellite bulls in an elk herd. And as he's running off these other bucks, it would be no problem at all for a young buck to slip in there and breed. You know, you talk about in 40 some years of hunting, you've seen a half a dozen occasions of tending, you call it. And I don't know if you're referring to actual breeding, but I'll tell you something. I've been deer hunting 45 years and I have never seen a wild doe being bred by a buck. Now, I've seen the situations, you know, where a buck has got a doe all by herself. And definitely it's a hot doe, maybe out in the middle of a wide open field or whatever. I see that every single season. I'll see that anywhere from two or three to a half a dozen times or more. So that's very common, but the actual breeding itself, I have never witnessed that in all my years. And I know a lot of guys have, but I personally never have.
Well, I think, when we talk about what one person's seen versus what other person's seen, I think that's a little subjective. I go back to what Dr. Strickland said when they do DNA testing on twins, that many times each twin being carried by the same doe has a different father. Mm-hmm. So that in itself should put in perspective for people how many bucks are climbing on top of a hot doe at different points and times in this cycle.
Could you hear me, Terry?
Yeah.
I think my
all right. We'll finish up with just that.
Okay.
See, people, I'm not even going to edit that out because we're as real can get. And Don said batteries on his headset just went dead. But Don, what I was saying is after Dr. Strickland said that about, you know, does having fawns, twin fawns with different fathers, it's not a matter of just, you know, one instance of breeding and then that doe is done. She's in cycle and multiple bucks are mounting her throughout that cycle. And what we see is just a snippet, and everybody sees different things. You've spent more time in a tree stand than anybody I know, and you've never seen a buck mount a doe. So again, I think we just have to accept the fact as hunters, there's a lot more to the whole scenario at any point in time in the year than what we have a visual sight to see.
And we also need to consider that Steve is from southern Iowa, where there's plenty of mature bucks. So I guarantee you there's a lot of yearling bucks breeding does in Pennsylvania and Michigan. So that could have some influence on what he sees as well.
Right. And we apologize if the audio just dropped. Just bear with us. We're going to go ahead and get through this episode. We got one more question, and we'll get through it and have patience with us here.
BuyAFarm.com is your source for farm, recreational properties, rural homes, and more. Now, here is Don Higgins with this week's featured property.
Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to the BuyAFarm.com Property of the Week segment with Don Bailey. Don, it's great to have you on the show tonight, and you have a good-looking track from Marion County, Illinois, that you want to feature.
Yeah, Terry, it's west of Salem, Illinois, then south. There's three 40-acre tracks of the same owner that can be bought separately or together. We took and had a evaluation of timber done for it, and the present value that they come up with $76,687. And it's got a full report of all the timber that's on that, which really helps of what to expect in the future. I really like it when we're able to get them done.
Right.
It's basically at the end of a road, the public road dead ends at one of the 40s. So you're going to have the privacy. And one thing that I liked about it, Terry, when I first went to it, I did not see a single four-wheeler track or UTV track on any of it, which is hard to find anymore.
It means people haven't been on it tromping it up.
Yes. There's deer pictures on our website. Several buck pictures and several just scattered deer pictures.
Yeah, I'm sharing a couple of those for the folks watching on YouTube right now. Some of the pictures of not only the big timber, you have a picture of a hat hanging on a tree so they can get the scale, the size, and then the thick cover, which is great bedding. But there's some dandy bucks on here, and I got to flat out just ask you, Don, are these bucks really from this property? Because we know how it rolls sometimes.
Yes, I 100% guarantee they came from one guy, one of the friends of the family. They didn't allow any other hunting. And one guy hunted this by himself only. Mm-hmm. And these pictures came directly from him. And I asked him that same question. You know, I don't want to put any pictures on there if they're ghost deer from another place. And he promised me, nope, them are from my trail cam over the years. And they come straight off of that property.
Yeah, that's kind because of a scam that some of the agents out there or outfitters do, is they post pictures that they find on social media or somewhere else and say they came off of that farm.
Well, it's just a natural. If you see a great big Boone and Crockett buck on there, you're drawn to it. You know? And I just, you know, it is what it is, Terry, but I just don't want to be a part of that.
Yep. That's how you guys separate yourself a little bit. Now, the tracks are divided into four different tracks, as you mentioned, and there is a plan if they're sold separately where there'll be easement. So I think unless you want to dive deep into that, the best thing to do is for people to go to buyafarm.com and pull up this property in Marion County. But I'm like you. I think that this timber appraisal in here, I think that's what they call it, is a timber appraisal or timber report. That's really handy for someone who's looking at buying a property like this because, you know, they're investing money, but this shows exactly what you can get as an immediate return when you go to log it.
Yes, and it's not just coffee shop talk or so on and so forth. This is a licensed guy that's what he does for a living. He goes and evaluates it. And not only the present timber value, but he counts. There's a full count of all the expected time that there'll be of harvest. You know, your oaks, your maples, your white oaks, acorns, any of them. And he's got them all spelt out. And that's hard to get a landowner convinced that that's going to be good information. But it's priceless. It really is.
Yeah, it's basically saying how big of a check you're going to be able to cash to go against the purchase price. So, again, these are four different tracks, and they can sell individually or multiples. And then there's the plan, if they're sold individually, how the easement will work. What else do you got to say about this property? I mean, you got a blend of heavy cover, big timber, and it looks like a good size open area on one of the tracks for some food plots. It looks like it has it all.
Yes, it has some bottom land that gets a light flooding on the south end, but it doesn't get any of the whole tracks. And I've looked at the soil types too, Terry, and it's got some magnificent soil types in certain areas to put some food plots in. Sometimes people don't pay attention to that soil type. Me being a fourth generation farmer, I that means the world to me.
Yeah, that's kind of where you gravitate to.
Yeah, you need to plant your food plots in an area that not only is covered, but if one side of it's lesser soils, that'll sustain your food plot. You need to move it over maybe 100 yards, mm-hmm. And people take that for granted, or they just don't know.
Right. But great location. How this is due east of St. Louis. How far would you say this is out of St. Louis, Don?
I'm going to say once you get out of St. Louis, an hour and a half.
Yeah, so not far at all. Great location, great property, either in individual tracts of around 40 acres, I believe, and then also the fourth tract, which is, I believe, the acre strip, which is the easement, I think. Is that right? Is that how that works?
No, actually, that
oh, I see.
Is
never
just
mind.
a simple strip that they ended up with. This has been in an estate for, I'm pretty certain over 50 years. I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say longer than 50 mm-hmm. years.
Right.
So it's not a tract that someone bought and convinced the sellers that it wasn't worth anything and are flipping right. it. This is straight from the heirs of the people that have owned it forever. So,
well, great location, great property. And even great bucks. This one's a whopper here, Don. I wouldn't mind hunting this if you can hook me up if it doesn't sell. How about that?
Yep, we'll work on it, certainly.
All right, well, if somebody wants to learn more about this property or others, tell them how to get in touch with you, Don.
Yes, me personally, Don Bailey, at 618-919-1031, at dbailey@biofarm.com. Or just simply go to our website, biofarm.com, scroll down on listings, and click on Marion County, and that'll bring you to it.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show again. We look forward to having you on the next episode. Take care, buddy.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The next question comes from Ryan Norton from Florence, Kentucky.
He's my neighbor.
Is your neighbor?
No, not my neighbor, but he lives close.
Yeah. He says, "Dear Don and Terry, when you talk about giant mature bucks, you always say they are a totally different animal. So in relation to the annual fall shift, do these big mature bucks that have found an out-of-the-way unpressured spot leave their safe place to relocate somewhere else in the fall? Or are they different from most other young bucks and stay put if they feel safe and have plenty of doe in the area? Have you ever experienced a time when a big mature just stayed put? Thanks for all the great things you guys are doing through this platform and telling the truth when this world needs it most." Well, Ryan, I think I described in an earlier question that, yeah, I've seen bucks that just stay put, Smokey and the 6x6x6 are two bucks on my place that did that. But I think as when a buck is, say, middle-aged, not when he's mature, not when he's young, by the time he's middle-aged, he starts settling into habits that he's going to carry for the rest of his life. So in other words, he's going to have a bachelor group where he goes every summer. And I've said it many times, I put my cameras on the same trees every summer and I get the same bachelor group there every summer. And he will settle into one of these patterns where he summers in this area and he shifts in the fall to another area. And I don't think it has anything whatsoever to do with hunting pressure. And the reason I say that is I remember a specific buck years ago that I was keeping tabs on that in the summertime, he was in a very secure area on a small piece of private property, did not get much hunting pressure at all. And there was a bachelor group there every summer, but that bachelor group would break up and I never could figure out where that buck went because I wanted to kill him. And finally, a friend of mine shot that buck and instead of going a direction that I thought he might have, he went and spent the fall on public land of all places. So instead of shifting to a safer location, he was actually shifting to a location where during hunting season, he was way more likely to encounter danger. So I think once a buck has established that pattern for himself, he's going to carry that right on through for most of his life.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation in itself. I wish we could ask a deer why they do stuff or what they like to eat, why they're doing different things throughout the year. But, you know, God's creation is so dynamic, and it's set up just as complicated as our human bodies to survive and to recreate and to take care of this earth. And I just think it's just a testament to the power and foresight and just awesomeness that our Creator has in being able just to speaking a few words, and all of a sudden that the animals have populated the planet. I think that's just so cool.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
So, well, thanks, Ryan, for your question. Before we sign off here, Don and I both have a situation we would like to talk a little bit about. And for those of you who are believers and believe in prayer, both of these are situations that we're going to ask you to at some point to drop what you're doing and pray specifically for these two situations with our Lester's Feet segment tonight.
Yeah, Terry, this week happened to be, this past week was my wedding anniversary, but it was also my youngest daughter's birthday. She turned 31 this week. And on her birthday, I received an email. It's totally unrelated to her birthday, but it really drove home the point of how blessed I am. One of our listeners, a young man named Brian Scott, sent me an email that I got on my daughter's birthday. And he asked for prayers. It was a fairly long email. Basically described a situation where, you know, him and his wife have been very blessed, and they've got a new baby, and that they had, you know, longed for a few years, and everything was going great in their life. And then recently his wife Haley came down with breast cancer, and he was asking for our prayers, and from the prayers from the Chasing Giants family, you know, for his family. And it really caused me to stop and reflect on, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this podcast? And it goes way beyond deer hunting. We're trying to have a positive influence in however it may be in people's lives. Part of that is, you know, to hopefully make them more successful as deer hunters. But I think an even bigger reason for this podcast is that, you know, we want to have a positive impact beyond deer hunting. And the fact that this young man thought enough of you and I and our podcast to reach out to us. And I've gotten, to be honest, I've gotten several of these, you know, over the past 2 or 3 years since we started doing this podcast, that we've got a platform unlike anything out there in the hunting community. And I want to personally do a better job of utilizing the platform we've been given to help others. And I think we do a really good job helping people become better deer hunters. And we've done a pretty good job in other ways. Through the Lester's Feet that you started, Terry, is a perfect example. I mean, we've raised over $500,000 now to help families that are going through, you know, unimaginable situations that you and I have never really had to. And when Brian, I guess it was the timing of his email on my daughter's birthday that really hit home, because Haley is 29 years old. She's actually 2 years younger than my youngest daughter, Alicia. And this young lady, new mother, is facing a very, you know, serious situation health-wise. And her husband is, I'm sure Brian feels almost helpless in the situation. And so what can we do? And I think that we have an opportunity to bring the entire Chasing Giants family, all our listeners together, to help each other in prayer. And if you don't believe that prayer works, then I'm here to tell you you're in the wrong spot, because Terry and I know without a doubt that it works. And we don't know what God's answer is to each and every prayer, but I've just seen in my own life that there's no doubt God is real. There's no doubt that He hears our prayers. And I want to take a moment at the end of this podcast to do something that I've never done on this podcast, and that's pray for not only Haley, but all of our listeners. And but first, I want to give Terry an opportunity to, I think he's got a situation that he became aware of this week as well that he'd like to share some details on.
Yeah, so one of my best friends and counterparts that I have with my day job, we were in Chicago this week, and we were downstairs in the hotel lobby, you know, talking pretty late about a situation with, you know, kind of future leaders coming up in the company and how we were going to try to direct them. You know, you have to kind of mentor as much as you try to try to learn. And we didn't go upstairs until about 12:30 that night. And about a half hour after he got to his room, he got a phone call. His youngest son, Connor, was walking on campus at Illinois State University, and a car jumped a curb and hit him walking. So he was a pedestrian and pinned him and his friend between the car and the wall. Connor was airlifted to Champaign, and he's currently stable. But this week has been a really rough week. We had to get my good friend Kevin out of downtown Chicago in the middle of the night, get the rest of his family and get them down to Champaign where Connor was airlifted. A lot of obviously repairs of pelvis, legs, you know, but at this point in time, he is off the ventilator. He's off the medically induced coma. Still don't know how far the extent of the injuries are going to be, but he's stable. He's going to live, but he has just an unbelievable road ahead of him for just a freshman in college. And it just goes to show how in just a blink of an eye, you can get that phone call that your wife has cancer, your kid's been hurt. And, you know, I can't imagine. You know, people question all the time, why is God doing this to me? What does God have against me? Is he punishing my kids because, or my wife because of mistakes that I've made? If anything that we can encourage people to do beyond deer hunting, it's don't blame God, don't question God, but trust in God. Because I can't imagine going through anything like these situations without leaning on God. And feeling the hopelessness that you can find when you're just sitting there waiting, trying to figure out what to do. As men, I know we've all sat in the situation where we say, give it to me, I'll take it, right? I mean, we would all, if one of our kids was sick, give it to me, I'll deal with it, spare them. There's so many emotions, so many questions that I know people have when they're hurting, but I can't imagine going through that hurting without the foundation and being able to lean on God. And if you're questioning that, reach out to one of us. If we can't answer that question, we'll find someone who can. But for these two people, I'm just going to ask, I talked to Kevin. He's the one that's my friend. He's the father. He was actually one of the first big supporters of Lester's Feet. I talked to him about it. He encouraged me to go ahead and do it. And then here, 2 years later, his kid's in a hospital bed. So thanks to the donors, you guys just paid for him to have a hotel next to the hospital so he could and his family could stay close to Connor. So I commend you. I think it's appropriate that we use this platform to pray. Heaven knows that these two situations and our country and our listeners need it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to make a habit of praying on every podcast. But I think there's situations where it's warranted. And, you know, I just ask that every listener consider these situations and consider what these families are going through. And all I'm asking is that you take 30 seconds of your time, and it won't cost you a penny. You just ask God to put his healing hand on each of these situations the same way that you would want others to be praying for you if it was your child or your wife going through this. So, with that, Father God, I want to thank you for this platform that you've given us. I want to thank you for each and every listener of Chasing Giants and for their support and what they've meant to Terry and I. I just ask that you've heard these two situations that I've described, that Terry's described with Connor and this young lady, Haley. Just ask that you touch both these situations, bring peace and comfort to their families and to these individuals, bring complete healing. Please guide the doctors as they treat these two situations. And Father, I know that there's others listening that are going through similar situations and maybe things totally much worse or things that are totally different. It may be situations with family issues or finances or whatever. I just ask that you guide and direct, you know, everyone through these situations. Let them know that you're there for them. Just guide Terry and I as we make decisions with Chasing Giants as we move forward, that we use this platform in a way that's glorifying and honoring to you, and that also brings our listeners in and makes these listeners feel a part of the Chasing Giants family, to let them know that we understand, that we are there for them. We are in their corner. I just ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thanks for your support, everyone.
God bless everyone. Have a great week.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo, Bia Farm Real Estate Company, 360 Hunting Blinds, Victory Chevrolet, Real World Wildlife Products, Matthews Archery, Novix Tree Stands, Gingerich Tree Farm, WildlifeFarming.com, Quiet Cat, and Vortex Optics. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.